On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The images out of Burma last week, out of Myanmar, were stunning, exotic, inspiring all over the internet, and then they were gone. Red-robed Buddhist monks, first padded in single file, cordoned by hand-holding young civilians. Then they marched in their thousands, chanting democracy, surrounded by Burmese crowds. Then came beatings and barbed wire and crackdown by Myanmar's military regime and empty streets again. What just happened here? And will the big powers that matter, China, India, do anything about it? Up next, On Point, the monks' revolt in Myanmar. Joining me first in this hour from Mae Sot, just across Myanmar's eastern border in Thailand, is Keen Omar. She works with a pro-democracy group called the Asia-Pacific People's Partnership on Burma. She was one of the main organizers of the last big uprising in Burma in 1988. She's been in exile since 1990. Keen Omar, thank you very much for joining us. What are you hearing today from Myanmar?
Well, what I've been hearing from the people on the ground is this is the time that we cannot lose it again. And people are saying, people are fully aware of Mr. Gambari's visit and having a very high expectation, which I'm also worried and afraid that what if their high expectation doesn't meet.
Mr. Gambari, of course, the UN special envoy who's been there for a couple of days now, not yet meeting with the top leaders of the country. You have been channeling a lot of information from the internet, images and reports out to the world. What are you hearing today? The press reports are saying everything is clamped down, sealed up in Rangoon, Yangon, and the rest of the country. Is that your understanding?
Well, on the surface, because there are the security forces are heavily deployed. Really, you know, throughout the, especially in the Rangoon, the city of Rangoon, across the Rangoon, you know, many monasteries been raided and rounded up by the army, whereas the roads are blocked. In spite of that heavy presence of the security forces, people, even today in the afternoon, still went onto the streets and tried to get into groups, but of course it was quite difficult that they were not able to do that. But they were actually on the streets today, and the number is less than the other days where the world had a chance to witness and see thousands, hundreds of thousands of people marching in columns on the street. This is not the case for the moment, but this is the surface that we see, but really the momentum doesn't die down yet, and people are still very determined and committed, and are still the outrage of what happened to the Buddhist monks is really hurt the people's feelings on the ground.
Keen Omar, you say Burmese are saying we cannot lose this time, and yet they've lost before in the face of this military regime. Can the people in Myanmar, democracy activists, be successful on their own, or must they have outside support to have a chance here?
Well, you know, I mean, for the people of Burma, how many times that, you know, the people of Burma, that we have proved to the world of our desire for freedom and democracy. Back in 1988, myself, my colleagues, you know, we were on the streets in the face of the devil, and we were shot and killed, you know, bloodily and really ruthlessly. And the world at that time didn't know, because the country was closed. There was no technology. Basically, the world didn't have a chance to see what really happened to us on the streets back in 1988. Again, in 1990, the people of Burma really proved to the world of their desire for democracy. And by that time, they really voted for Aung San Suu Kyi and National League for Democracy. And again, the 1990 election results were completely ignored by the regime. And now, after that, there were times that there were demonstrations. People in 1990, the Buddhist monks actually had their first excommunicative boycott against the regime, and that was brutally cracked down again. Again in 1996, again in 1998. Here we are again in 2007, and this is again the largest of hundreds of thousands across 65 cities across the country. You know, there are 219 times of demonstrations over the past 2 months. And this is the time the world must act on, or the Burma will turn to another killing field.
Kin Omar on the border of Myanmar, of Burma in Thailand, with us today with the Asia-Pacific People's Partnership on Burma. Good luck. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We turn now to Bangkok, Thailand, and Simon Montlake. He's correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been listening along with us. Simon Montlake, thanks very much for being here. What are you hearing out of Myanmar today? What's going on or not going on there?
Well, it is very quiet in terms of on the streets. I mean, shops and businesses have reopened. I suppose there's a sense of people, restarting their lives again. I mean, that's not to say that any of the anger, the fear, the hatred, all those feelings haven't gone away, but there's a certain weariness of a Monday of people starting again. I think from my point of view, from the reporter's point of view, what we're focused on is the visit of Mr. Gambari, the UN envoy. I think at this point, the diplomatic front is becoming quite crucial, and that's what we're going to be watching in the days ahead.
Tell us about the crackdown. What is known at this point about the number arrested, imprisoned, killed?
Well, the number killed, the official figure is very low, something like 10 or so. But, I mean, anyone you talk to has got, you know, horrible stories to tell. And I think the diplomats in Rangoon who are trying to, wrap together what they're hearing would say, well, let's expect the figure to be much higher than that. But, I mean, some exile groups talk about up to 200 people dead. We really have no way of verifying that. I mean, what's happened in some cases is that people, bodies have actually been taken off the streets by the troops, taken away, and people aren't sure where they've gone. Now, these could be people who are either injured, people who were shot dead, or even just people who are picked up as part of a sort of mop-up campaign. So there's a lot of people that have gone missing, and this is a familiar pattern. The same thing did happen back in 1988 during the previous uprising. So it's a little bit hard to say, but definitely we know that hundreds of monks have been arrested and taken away, and that's had a big impact on what we've seen over the last week or so. It really has been very difficult for the monks to organize and to protest again.
Reports of barbed wire around monasteries and the beating and disrobing of monks. We're going to look at what's happened with Burma's monks here, but what about the big powers watching this, Simon? You're writing today, the attention may have moved to the diplomatic front, but you're not writing very optimistically about the powers that matter stepping in here.
Well, I think that's because for all that President Bush and other people in the U.S. would say, how much their talk of sanctions really matters, it doesn't really matter. What matters are the countries which are the trading partners, political partners, and strategic allies of Burma, and that comes down essentially to China, plus Southeast Asian countries, India, perhaps Russia as an arms supplier. But, I mean, the first among equals would be China. And quite frankly, I mean, China's position on Burma, as it is on a lot of unsavory regimes, is that unless it's actually a threat to international security, then its political affairs are domestic affairs. We're just here to, you know, do business. I mean, that's essentially the line. And I think what goes with that, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. What goes with that is the idea that, well, if we take the Western line, the UK or the US or even European line of, we don't want to deal with these people, we think there should be sanctions, there should be punishment for what they've done, is that really going to lead the generals that rule Burma in any other direction? I think the Chinese would argue, and other Asian countries would argue, that actually over the long term, engagement is the way to go. And for that end, you would talk about trade, you would talk about investment. And so China is going to be both looking for Burma to remain stable, to remain in its patch, a friend of China, and also for Burma to provide, you know, economic opportunities. And I don't think sanctions fits into any of those categories.
Washington announced sanctions on a dozen top generals in Burma. Will that have any impact whatsoever? Them being barred from moving money around the United States?
It's hard to see that having an impact. And to be honest, I spoke to a U.S. diplomat in this region who I can't name, and I said to him, look, these sanctions are not going to do anything. And he just said, yes, you're right. They're not going to change the general's opinion today. I mean, these guys, these generals, they don't leave Burma very often. I mean, their children may go off to Hong Kong or Bangkok or Singapore on the weekend and come back with a bag full of duty-free. But, I mean, essentially, they are not looking to the U.S. in a way that perhaps Asian elites in other countries do. I mean, you know, the idea that the generals would send their children to Harvard or that they'd be doing business there is kind of absurd at this point. I mean, they are so well entrenched in what they have, and there are so many other banking centers and, you know, education centers around this region. They don't necessarily need the U.S. I think they've done without them for a long time. So I don't think that Washington's sanctions are going to make much short-term difference. It will only essentially confirm the general's belief is that, you know, America and the West is against them, and they've got to hold together because they're the only force that can keep the country strong. I mean, it does feed into their somewhat paranoid vision that Burma is this country which needs to stand up to the, you know, to the colonial powers, and regime change is the last thing on their mind.
But with China and India looking at all the oil and gas there, building pipelines and ports and all the rest, is there really any chance they're going to put significant pressure on this government to change?
I think the answer is only if they feel that by pushing the government to change, it would create a more stable and prosperous environment for themselves. Now, there is an argument to be made here that the generals have essentially run the country almost into the ground. I mean, it's a very country that's rich in natural resources, and it could be doing a lot better. I mean, it's surrounded by countries which are prosperous, dynamic, and moving forward. Burma clearly isn't.
We've heard there from the border of Burma in western Thailand, on the eastern border of Burma, and from Bangkok. I want to pull the lens back a little bit now and talk with a couple of Burma watchers, Myanmar watchers, who know the country very, very well. First, joining us from Singapore, David Steinberg is with us. He's been a Myanmar watcher going back to the 1950s, one of the leading scholars in the United States on Myanmar, director of Asian Studies at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, author of Turmoil in Burma. David Steinberg, thanks very much for being with us from Singapore today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Also with us from New York, Robert Templer. He is the Asia Program Director for the International Crisis Group. Robert Templer, thank you for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you for having me today.
David Steinberg, first to you. What has just happened here? What have we seen? There have been uprisings in Burma before. Is this one different? Is it the same thing? Is something changing or not here?
Something is changing. There's a cumulative kind of frustration, economic, political, social frustration that has been built up over time. And it is getting, I'm afraid, worse. The government has put it down. It was very cautious about how it did it at the beginning. But we have to understand in thinking about this that Buddhism is a critical element in Burman society. Burmans make up two-thirds of the population. And as somebody wrote, to be Burman is to be Buddhist. But Buddhism is not necessarily the only the otherworldly religion we think about when we think of the Buddhist text. In fact, it's been political since the British occupation. The monks were the nationalist leaders. They were martyrs in British jails. Every politician, including the military, including the civilians, although they devoutly believe in Buddhism, used it for their own political purposes. And so Buddhism becomes central to the whole legitimacy of the government. And this is what the crisis is coming to today. And the question is how much of this legitimacy, in their own terms, the military has lost by doing what they have done.
David Steinberg, let me ask you, I should say, just point out to people, we have a big gallery of some of these amazing photos that have come out of Myanmar, out of Burma, in the last week. You can see them at our website, onpointradio.org. There's a gallery there. There are several galleries you can click on out to. The internet and cell phone cameras and brave journalist photographers have brought us some quite astonishing images here. And David Steinberg, let me just ask you about some of these, if I may. I mean, I'm sure you saw them, too. I'm looking at one right here from fairly early on, but already you've got monks in their red robes, four abreast. This is in the streets of Rangoon. And, I mean, the line just goes on and on and on. Rangoon looks something like 1960s or 70s Bangkok to my eye. How unusual.
It is unusual. It's unusual that they allowed them to get out. But if you look at these monks, they're all quite young. We have to understand that the hierarchy is controlled by the military. The military is very strict about registering monks, about making sure that only a certain number of sects of monks or Buddhists are allowed, what they are taught to get Buddhist degrees and so forth. But they cannot control each individual monastery or the younger monks. The younger monks being, in fact, young people who share the nationalism and share the desire for, I think, more freedom that the civilians share as well.
And we should say these are not like, let's say, Catholic priests. Many of these monks are just in for a few months, a year, a couple of years, so they flow in and out of Burmese society.
That's true, and there are far greater numbers in terms of percentages of the male population than in, let's say, in our society in terms of, or Catholic societies in general.
I'm reading here 400,000, maybe as many monks as there are soldiers in Burma.
Including novices, that may well be true. There may be a couple hundred thousand monks who are pretty stable in terms of their belonging to the Sangha, to the monkhood. But they have a very important role in the society. They are not only the moral force. Traditionally, they were the education factors in the society before the British introduced secular education. They were they're the leaders of the village communities. Every village has its monastery. Every village has its pagoda. And these become the real focus of life in these areas. So the monkhood is terribly important.
So now we have reports and images of monks being beaten, of monasteries being surrounded by barbed wire, monks being trucked away in military trucks. If the regime in Burma can do that and get away with it, does that mean it is untouchable, David Steinberg?
I don't think it's untouchable. I think the question really is, since the military is basically Buddhist as well and very strongly religious, will this pressure, from the moral pressure from what they have done to the monks, begin to foment dissent within the military ranks? In other words, will the military, which has been kept together in spite of policy differences, in spite of personality differences, in spite of even the financial interests of some of the children of the leaders, because they realized they needed that for their own survival, will this become overwhelming? And if it doesn't happen now, this builds up over time. This is a cumulative thing, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. It's not just something that will die down. It will come again at some point. And eventually the military itself, I think, will determine that the military's role is so important in that society, it is being besmirched and its reputation is being hurt, and something must be done by the military to regain their prestige in the society.
Of course, it's been many, many years already. San Suu Kyi in under house arrest for, the better part of 14, 15 years. Robert Templer in New York, as you look out here, there are calls for the big powers to do something, but the biggest powers right next door are India and especially China. Is there any chance of China, you know, where we saw Tiananmen in 1989, where democracy is not exactly the number one priority, intervening in a significant way here?
Well, China's urged restraint, and it has made public statements that have gone beyond what it usually says about other countries. But I don't think China either has the will or the actual ability to snap its fingers and create some sort of transformation in Burma. It has a complicated relationship with Burma. It has very profound interests there. It has more than a million Chinese living there, has very considerable economic interests.
You mean ethnic and Chinese, not Chinese citizens?
No, but a lot of them are Chinese citizens as well.
Wow. I'm reading here about 40 hydropower projects China's involved in there, 17 oil and gas projects, plans announced to build a 1,500-mile oil and gas pipeline from Myanmar to China's Yunnan province. With all of that, Robert Templer, I suppose China does then have an interest in stability, but that's different from democracy.
Yes, I think what it would like to see there is a stable government that was actually reforming its economy, that was creating wealth and opportunities for its people. I don't think it's happy with the situation, and indeed it has tried to get the generals to change their outlook, particularly on the economy. It's had very little influence on that. This is not a regime that is easily moved by any other country.
David Steinberg, could China change the politics in Myanmar if it wanted to?
I think it could help the change it, but there's something here we're ignoring, and that is the way we try and put pressure on Myanmar. The Chinese have been very quiet and subtle. We, the West, the United States especially, has sort of beat the Burmese military around the head and shoulders, verbally I'm talking. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, it forces the Burmese military to have a nationalistic reaction and say, we will stand up to you. The Chinese have been more careful. Now, after all, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State went to Beijing and met with three Burmese ministers in July, I believe. That could not have been done unless the Chinese were really concerned about the situation. So the Chinese are putting this quiet pressure, I think, maybe we think it's not enough, but quiet pressure which at least allows the Burmese a face-saving way, perhaps, to move into a more moderate form.
But in the meantime, years and years and years go by, and nothing really changes in Myanmar. Is all that quiet interaction, you know, is that going to mean a lot to the people who were arrested, let's say, over the weekend in a country where, you know, detention is long and torture is a kind of standard interrogation technique, we're told?
Yeah. And, well, detention is arbitrary and there's no rule of law as we understand it. I mean, it's rule of regulations, of course. And so it may not be that long, but at the same time, it is very unfortunate. It is a tragedy for the society. There are tragedies for the individuals. There are tragedies for the country as a whole, because the country as a whole will not get the foreign aid it needs to develop. It will even get less humanitarian aid, probably. And even the modest movement of the country towards a military-controlled civilianization under the new constitution will probably be delayed some. So even these marginal openings will be suspended for a while. So I think the situation is very dire. I quite agree. I think that Mr. Templer and Mr. Motley's analyses have been quite accurate.
David Steinberg in Singapore and Robert Templer in New York, please stand by. We have a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. And the very first one turns out to be a former, the last full-fledged American ambassador to Burma. Burton Levin is calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Mr. Levin, thank you very much for calling in. What are you seeing unfolding
here?
Hi.
Well, I think all this talk about China, Russia, India having the ability to put pressure, bring about change in Burma is overstated. This Burmese military leadership is xenophobic, nationalistic, and very poorly educated. They are not going to bow to any outside pressure. They feel that they themselves are the protectors of the country, the saviors of the country, and they are just immune. They give no importance to the economic interests of Burma. They just see themselves as the state, as the rulers of Burma.
So let me ask you, Ambassador Levin, when we see these images, and again, there are many at our website, onpointradio.org, of monks coming out first in a trickle and then in a sea and all the Burmese around them, and then the scenes of tear gas and beating and death, that means what? The world can do nothing? Should just stand by? Nobody
no,
can...
Mm-hmm. No, Tom, I saw sights in 1988 that were gruesome. I saw soldiers run down students who were fleeing and shooting them as if they were hunting rabbits. I would hope that the specter of a military beating monks who are so sacred to the population of Burma, would produce consternation within the armed forces, within the Burmese armed forces. The hope in my mind is a split, a coup within the military forces. Now, we know very little about the dynamics of the leadership within the Burmese military. We do know that there are fracture lines there. A all-powerful head of intelligence, a man by the name of Kin Yuen, who at the time seemed to be the most powerful person in Burma, was purged a few years ago on charges of corruption. There have been other instances of rumblings within the military. So I am hoping that the shame created by these persecution and beatings of monks and by international pressure, the international pressure is not going to get this leadership to change its course. The hope is that international pressure will create even more of consternation within the ranks of the military. That's what I see as the hope.
Ambassador Levin, we're glad you've called in. Stick with us for a moment if you would. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've spent a couple of years living in Southeast Asia, and China would like very much to have good relations with Laos, Vietnam, and Myanmar, as their industry grows. Now, the American people can have an influence. Walmart is one of the biggest trading partners that China has. If every American, which is one of three, that shops at Walmart, wrote in to the Walmart leadership and told them they were not going to buy, Walmart could exert pressure onto the Chinese, which do a little arm twisting in Myanmar.
Tom, let us pick up just that idea, if we may. Robert Templer, let me come to you with it. Okay, Tom wants Americans to write into Walmart. Is this our new conduit to the world? Put the pressure on Walmart, Walmart on China, and things change in Myanmar.
I'm afraid it's not going to be that simple. I agree with the ambassador who called in that it's extremely difficult to influence this regime. I'm not necessarily convinced by the effectiveness of sanctions. I mean, all around the world, we've seen an array of sanctions on North Korea, on Cuba, on China itself for a long time, on Vietnam until 1994. And in none of these cases did those sanctions force a change in government in those countries. It simply isn't an effective mechanism to get the sort of changes we want to see in Burma. I think there needs to be an emphasis on a whole array of other issues, as well as the issue of democracy. This is a country that's been at war for 60 years. It's the longest running war on earth. And we desperately need to focus a little more on some of those conflicts and in resolving some of those conflicts.
You're talking Myanmar at war with ethnic groups within the country? Is that what you're referring to?
Within the country, yeah. Mm-hmm. We also need to deal with an extraordinary humanitarian crisis that's in this country. No country that is suffering at the level to which Burma is suffering can expect to have any form of political stability. There are a number of areas. Sanctions don't help these areas. They don't help to create the openings in society. They don't create the momentum for change from within a society. I think we've seen in Iraq how effective it is to try and impose democracy on a country.
And yet we have the blogs coming out of Burma in the last week, and they're begging, they're saying, somebody out there help us. We can't do this alone. Ambassador Levin, we've just got you for a couple more seconds here. Do you see the U.S. as kind of an outlier here? Can it really play an important role, or is it now second tier when it comes to Myanmar?
I really don't see us playing a major role. I would hope, though, that we do speak to the Chinese, to the Indians, to the Russians, and try to get them. Not that in the expectation it's going to have an immediate payoff, but just in the hope of creating tensions within the military leadership and demonstrating to the people of Burma that there is a very broad international support and sympathy for their striving for greater freedom and a better nation.
Burton Levin, the last full-fledged American ambassador in Burma, left in 1990. Ambassador Levin, thank you for calling in. Great to have
you. Thank you, Tom.
And by the way, there's a great gallery of images of what we've seen in this last week at our website, onpointradio.com. .org. Let's take a call right now from Maynard, Massachusetts. Andrea is calling. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm all right.
I commend you for bringing the issue up on your show. I just wanted to point out something short, and that is that the probability of China bringing any true pressure to the Burmese government is very low, given that this is highly reminiscent of the brutality that they themselves exercised on the Buddhist monks in Tibet. And the West watched as it happened, and basically nothing happened here. There was a small Free Tibet movement for a while that died off, and as we speak, they are still subject to that same brutality. And I don't think that the Chinese think it's morally questionable, and as long as their economic status is not threatened there, they're going to do absolutely nothing. And that was it.
So don't hold our breath waiting for China to do something here. Andrea, thanks very much for that. Robert Templar, I guess it is obvious that democracy is not the Chinese goal. I mean, they actively resist it in their own country. So when China looks at Myanmar, is it just about stability? And if it's stability, do they care how that's achieved?
They do want stability. They would like it to be much more stable than it is now. I think the country is going to descend into even greater chaos as a result of the past week's events and the terrible things that have happened there. It does erode the very little legitimacy the military has even further. But I think in general, the Chinese approach to their neighbors is that as long as there is stability and as long as there are good relations, they don't really care what type of government it has. And they have, for example, been talking to the National League for Democracy, the opposition. They have been talking to other elements in Burma in case there is a transformation there. I think China would essentially just want a government that's stable and maintains good relations with China.
Let's take a call from Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had the privilege of practicing meditation in Burma at one of the most famous monasteries at the Mahasi Center in Rangoon from 1979 to 1980, and I can personally attest to how highly regarded the monks are. It's just a tragedy, and it's unconscionable to consider that the Burmese soldiers would actually fire upon these monks, and I would hope, echoing former Ambassador Levin's point, that some of them would just rebel against the thought that their mortal souls would be in danger. According to the Buddhist traditions, it's considered a mortal sin to fire upon a monk. The culture is so highly esteemed. So I express some frustration and sadness, knowing that this is nonviolent revolution is not going the way, say, the Velvet Revolution went in Europe and in other areas as well.
And that from someone who studied Buddhism right there, David Steinberg, do you see something emerging here? Some of those young soldiers may have been young monks, for all I know. They may go back and forth.
They probably have been. There's something here that we have to understand about Chinese role. It is very profound, as we've all said, but also it's very dangerous, and the Chinese know this. According to the military themselves, informally, there are about 1.5 million, perhaps, illegal Chinese in Burma. And they have a greater wealth. They have obvious control of large elements of Upper Burma in terms of the economy. When the situation gets very bad, the people can turn against the Chinese. And the Chinese, I think, realize that. I mean, this has happened in 67 in Burma. It happened, of course, in Jakarta in 92 or so.
Right, of course.
There was a religious element there. So it is dangerous for China. I think China is quite concerned. It is not prepared to do anything that would really be public. But behind the scenes, I think they really want change. And I think when we're talking about democracy, we have to understand something else. Remember that this country has been terribly, terribly controlled. Every book that came into that country since 1962 or so has been censored. The younger people have not been able to read about democracy. I think they equate democracy with getting the military out of power, out of administrative power.
That seems like a reasonable equation, doesn't it?
Well, I think it is an important equation there. And one other thing on the sanctions, I agree with what has been said before about the ineffectiveness of sanctions. Actually, President Bush the other day to the UN talked about new sanctions. But in fact, in 2003, he imposed those very sanctions, froze all the assets, prevented new trade and so forth, prevented the use of the U.S. financial institutions. And when they confiscated money from Myanmar, it was a few $100,000. It was minuscule. So this is not going to have the effect. And once you impose sanctions, they're very difficult to get rid of.
Let me take a call from Carol in Galesburg, Illinois. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
We know how important names are, and I notice you and other news commentators are also saying are varying, going between Burma and Myanmar. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
That is a great question. David Steinberg, give us the history here. Is there a political connotation to these two? Is Myanmar...
It has become a political symbol. What happened is that the military in 1989, a government that the opposition feels is illegitimate, changed the name of the state. They changed it to an old written form of the state. It wasn't something they just made up.
Mm-hmm.
But they felt that this was good to be their interest. Now, of course, at that same time, they were pushing tourism. So what you did was to push the new name of a country which people couldn't even pronounce, which didn't do well for the tourist industry at the time. But it is a surrogate indicator of political opinion. That is why in many things that I write, I use both. I use it without political connotation.
I noticed that some of the democracy activists seem to use Burma. So is it a statement against the regime to use Burma instead of Myanmar? Is Myanmar seen as imposed on the populace?
It is. And as other countries have changed their names, they've allowed the use of the old name for the earlier period before the name was changed. For example, for many years, the Bank of in Sri Lanka, the Bank of Ceylon was used, the central bank, rather than the Bank of Sri Lanka. But in Myanmar, they go back to the 11th century, and everything is Myanmar. You cannot find an official publication that allows you to use the term Burma.
So that's a kind of a little bit of year zero dynamic there, or go back to the old way. Let's take a call from Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Charles, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I saw an article several months back in the New York Times about the Burmese government moving their central government out of the capital city. Just wondering if that was maybe them seeing writing on the wall or if anyone has more information on that.
Yeah, let us
and
pick
I'll,
that up.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Charles. David Steinberg, of course, it was Rangoon, or Yangon as it's now called.
Yangon.
Yangon, excuse me. And now it's a couple of hundred miles north in the kind of the middle of nowhere by Burmese standards and a very bunkered administrative capital, we're told. Why?
Well, there are at least half a dozen reasons that are given. Among them are astrological reasons, numerological reasons, a fear that Rangoon was too accessible to invasion, a feeling that it had to be they wanted the capital closer to control the minorities, a feeling that it would be better in the dry zone, which is more the seat of Burman culture. But where it is now, and I was up there last year, is not really unknown. It's on the main rail line from Rangoon to Mandalay, the main road. It was once near a site of an important agricultural research station. But it is an enormous undertaking for a government that has limited funds. And the amount of money that has gone into that has been very extensive.
But is it in also, part to get the government away from population centers, away from the people
exactly.
that might protest?
It's a government town. There's nobody there except for a market for local people that isn't working for the government, so that it is quite highly protected. You can have all your riots in Rangoon, but it's not going to have the government collapse.
Let's take a call from Iowa City, Iowa. Lydia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is, why are you asking if people are praying? Because A, it's not clear that everybody is religious, we know that. And B, it's certainly not clear that prayer is any effective means of getting things done. It's not a replacement for rational construction.
Yeah, Lydia, I guess don't take me too literally. I'm thinking of moral support sort of, you know, beaming out to those monks and protesters in the streets, and perhaps they bring prayer to mind with their very robes. But what we're hearing today, Lydia, is it seems that there's hardly anything that can be done. I mean, what else is there?
Well, you mean other than to just wish them well?
In a sense, yes.
I mean, I certainly don't have a solution as to what could be done. My concern is that when one says prayer, you're certainly invoking a religious term, and I felt that probably a lot of the audience felt excluded by, you know, what can we do? We can think about it. We can think about things rationally, but praying and just thinking, oh, I wish them well, or I pray to a God for them to be helped, it just doesn't seem to make much sense.
Yeah, Lydia, thanks very much.
I don't know what the solution would be.
No, Robert Templer, I'm driven to that language in part because it's not easy to see levers here that could be pulled on behalf of the people of Burma, I guess. You know, if you're an American looking at this politically, what? We hear right to Walmart, and then we're told that may not do anything either.
Well, there are a number of things you can do. The first thing, I think, which is completely critical, is to learn something about the background to this problem. And I would recommend that you read any one of David's books or The River of Lost Footsteps by Tan Min Yu, which is an excellent introduction to the history of this conflict and explains a lot about why it's going on. There are also other things that Americans can do. Nowadays, when I go around the world and talk to governments about human rights issues, they laugh in my face and say, we're doing this because America tortures people, because it locks them up without trial, and because it disappears people into secret prisons. Unfortunately, America's moral leadership on this issue has been squandered, and it needs to be recovered. America is an incredibly important force when it comes to supporting human rights around the world. So the first thing Americans should do is recover that. I also think in terms of the context of Burma, there's a huge amount that that can be done on the border areas where there are terrible problems with violence. There's a huge amount that could be done in terms of the UN process. I think one needs to be patient. I don't think anything is going to happen overnight. And unfortunately, there will be, I believe, recurrences of this sort of violence. I think it's a terrible tragedy, but inevitable, given the lack of real basis for change at the moment there. I also think that that people can apply pressure and should apply pressure. But sort of immediate steps, the rehashing of sanctions, as we saw by the U.S. government last week, they're not going to make any significant change. What we need is a long-term plan to affect real political change in this country.
Let me take a call from Kurt in Cedar Falls, Iowa, if I may. Kurt, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. I heard some discussion about the name Myanmar and Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working with Burmese refugees in Thailand these last few years. And my understanding that Aung San Suu Kyi has asked people to use the term Burma, or the name Burma, because the name Myanmar was adopted by what she considers to be an illegitimate government.
So there's the political spin on that bifurcation of the name, but it brings up a very important player, and I'm glad you have, Kurt. David Steinberg, what about Aung San Suu Kyi? The monks were actually allowed, or I don't know if they were allowed or just did it, but they marched past her gate. We're told that she was praying behind the gate, that they were chanting, you know, long life and health to Aung San Suu Kyi, may she have freedom soon. Is there a new link being forged here? And if so, what significance?
No, it's not a new link.
Mm-hmm.
She's a remarkable woman and a very brave woman. There's no question about that. That the military allowed her to some of the monks to go by her place is quite unusual, and indicating that they were not really sure perhaps how they should deal with this monk's uprising, if you will. She's a critical factor, but she's used very, very loosely in this process. She did not win the 1990 election. The National League for Democracy did, but she was under house arrest, so she couldn't run. The senior general...
That was her organization that won, you're saying, but not her personally.
It's her organization. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
The senior general, according to all reports, won't even hear her name mentioned in the country. They talk about the lady. They don't use her name. And the result is that we equate everything that goes on in terms of the opposition with her. She is very important. She is a symbol. But she can also be wrong on occasion in terms of the strategies that are used to try and get amelioration of the problems in the society. One thing that one should mention in terms of background, I can't stress enough the value of the early ICG reports that Mr. Templer has produced on Myanmar. They are excellent background. I assign them to students. And the other issue that is important is the role of the U.S. in terms of saving the country. I had an email from somebody who said the U.S. should send in troops and save the country. Now, that is something the military fears, and they fear Thailand because it's an American ally. The United States obviously cannot do that under practical circumstances today, but even under moral circumstances, it would unite the Burmese against the U.S. But there is always the danger by inciting rebellion and then not doing anything about it. We end up with a Hungarian Revolution situation where we took in refugees and we didn't help, but we incited the rebellion itself.
That is to rise up and then simply watch it fall. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time, but it's been great speaking with both of you. David Steinberg with us today from Singapore, author of Turmoil in Burma. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Robert Templer at the International Crisis Group in New York. Robert Templer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A big welcome today to our newest listeners in Vermont on Vermont Public Radio. It's great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.